This is a Pinball News production.
All right. thanks for coming. Let me jump to the beginning and start for real. So I'm Mark Gibson. I built this wacky stuff that you might have seen earlier at the show. I build a lot of stuff like this. And what this talk is going to be about is why I bother and what it's all about and what it's for. And you'll be able to come up and try and play with it all and see what it's doing for you. A little bit about me. I've been collecting pinball for a number of years, a long time. I do a lot of restoration work. And in restoring games, I've often admired the insides as much as the outsides. I mean, the way they're put together, the way the mechanisms work, things like that really intrigue me. And I've always enjoyed working and tinkering with things, and most recently, pinball. I started building things like this several years ago. A friend of mine gave me an orphaned head of a pinball machine, EM pinball machine. And I brought this to the showdown several years ago. What I did is the cabinet was long gone. We had no idea where it was. But the rest of this was really too good to part out. It was too good to throw away. So I spent a little time thinking, what could I do with it? And what I did is I put if you're familiar with the atomic clocks that you can get in the drugstore that always receive the time so they're always right. Well, I got the little radio receiver that they use and put that in the game and built the circuitry and whatnot so that it shows the time on the score reels. It's a clock, basically. So it sets itself. It picks up the radio. It knows what time it is. You don't have to set it. You just turn it on and walk away, and it does everything on its own. It works great here in Colorado because the signal comes from north of Fort Collins. It works great in California parts of the day, but not all day. I took it out to California for a show a few years ago, and I could not get the signal during the show. So the way the clocks work is they will get it at least once a day, but they don't necessarily get it all day long, and that I didn't realize. So that was the first sort of hacky thing that I did. Several years went by, and things started happening in Maker Faires. I don't know if anybody's familiar with these, but Maker Faires have started, in the mid-2000s with very few people interested, but have grown quite dramatically, as that chart shows. Maker Faires are where people gather to show off crazy stuff like this, things that they've built. I mean, if it's for people who want to understand how things work or want to make their things do better things. Like if your phone has a great app on it, but it'd be so much better if it just did one more thing, or if your toaster oven had one more setting or something like that. The makers are the people who will open them up and figure out how they work and figure out how to make it do exactly what you want rather than what the manufacturer thought you wanted it to do. So I got pretty excited about the whole Maker Faire thing. It seems to fit well with what I do. And then a few years ago, in 2013, the first one, well, it was in Colorado, in Loveland. So knowing that that was coming to town, I got thinking, what can I do? What can I take to show? How can I be a part of this thing? And a friend suggested, knowing that I do restorations, that I take some of my pinball machines, restored pinball machines, to the Maker Faire. And that's not really in the spirit of Maker Faire. It's about cleaning. Restoring is really different than making. Making is about making something new. And I thought, but I definitely want it to be pinball related. And I had been to the Pacific Pinball Museum and had seen the visible pinball. I don't know if anybody's played this thing, but it's a work of art, and it works exactly like you'd expect it to. But you can look through it. They've replaced all the wood with Lexan or polyacrylic or whatever. And it's really a remarkable piece of equipment. And there are actually several of these things now. I love this thing. It costs a fortune to build one, and that was more than I could do and more than I can afford in the 2 or 3 months that I had to get ready for Maker Faire. But I had another inspiration from a collection I had seen at a university a long time ago of these old mechanical models that were built to teach students how things work, how mechanical devices work. And these kind of things, if you just take a moment, you can imagine what these do, right? You turn the crank and the knob and the wheel turns. The first one here is a worm gear. So, I mean, they're used inside of circular saws and things like that now. The next one is used for pushing pressurized air or exhaust through a system. This is an air pump. But just turning the crank, you could see how it works, and maybe you can even picture it without even touching it, right? It's just clear what it does. And the one on the bottom is a universal joint, so you turn one crank and the other one cranks, regardless of the angle between the two. They just happen to work. And I love the way that it just you can look at it and figure out what it does. And when I was getting ready for this talk, I found this model in that same collection. And this is called a Geneva wheel. And I don't know how many people are familiar with what a Geneva wheel is. But you can imagine if you turn the crank on the circle on the left, the one on the right will turn only when that pin comes by. So if I do a complete turn on that crank, one revolution on that crank, I will get that other wheel to turn 1/8 of a turn. And so it turns a constant motion into an intermittent motion, if that makes sense. These are used in projectors. So when the film has to advance and then stop, and advance and stop, and advance and stop, this is what they're using. Well, what's cool about this is that this is actually used in a pinball machine. I don't know if you recognize this part yet, but the Geneva wheel is used in a very popular game. And you can order these parts from Marco, actually. So this, the part on top, is analogous to the left side. And the part on the bottom is analogous to the right side. So that the if I look here we go. So this round edge, this lip here, is going to fit right in here. And it's not going to move that black piece until that pin catches into this chute. And then it's going to turn that thing a quarter turn for every revolution of the Geneva wheel. So if you didn't recognize it, this is in the gumball machine of Twilight Zone. Right? It's a simple device, but it's like 200 or 300 years old. It's a remarkable piece of equipment. That's not clear yet, this is where they sit. So your gumball machine has a motor on it, and it takes a full revolution when you load the gumball, but the platter here that lets the ball fall through only turns a quarter turn, and it's using that Geneva wheel mechanism. So anyway, I took these ideas, the visible pinball, you can see everything happening, and these models where if you just look for a minute, you can say, aha, this is exactly how that works. I wanted to apply that to pinball. So I started building these things. I thought, you know, how can I show people the beauty of what's inside? It's not necessarily all about the artwork and the blinky lights and everything. There's a lot of clever stuff going on inside. And so I came up the first one with this. Same idea. I hooked it up the wire to power, and the lights go on, and you hit the button, the pop bumper works, and you can do it enough times and figure out, if you've never looked underneath the play field, you can figure out what it's going to do, and you can watch it and happen. Watch it happen in front of you. And part of my pinball collection obsession business is I enjoy old catalogs. And so when I build a board, I take the old schematic from the catalog and build a little sign out of it that I can put on display along with the board. So if I'm not there to explain it, somebody can go through and say, oh, this is what it's from, this is what it's for, this is how it works. Come to find out that nobody reads signs. You know, so that's just the way it is. So I started with a pop bumper, and that worked great. And I moved on to a flipper, and that worked great. Started taking it a little bit further. So these are relays. There's, you know, different kinds of relays. There's an interlock relay here and a standard relay. I've added lights here so that as you hit the buttons, lights go on and off, captures people's attention, and shows you where the connections are being made and not made. This one I kind of made up because you need to understand, if you understand anything about pinball, how a solenoid works, right? You put power through a coil of wire and you get a magnetic field which pulls a plunger up through the middle of this thing. So it turns out this is a flipper coil, but it works well because the flipper coil has a weak winding and a strong winding. So if you use the weak winding, you put current through it, it pulls it very slowly so you can see it move rather than pop up like it might in a game. So this is the basis of everything else that you're going to see. So at this point, I was, you know, had a couple months left, and I had a bunch of parts that I had removed from restorations. So I started building more. I've got score reels here. These each button will advance each score reel, but there's two rows of them because score reels either increment or they reset to zero, and there are two different circuits on them. So the first button advances and advances. You keep going. You go right past zero to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 again. And the back row is used to stop at zero. And it's an important point to make that, you know, the design has to allow the thing to stop to zero because that's the only time in the game when it knows what score is on is showing on the score reels, right? I mean, there might be a couple of award levels later on, but at any given moment, it has no idea what's on the score. So knowing when you're at zero and when to stop is an important feature. These are zipper flippers. You can have a look here in a minute. They're back here. And this one actually will flip up so you can see the underside to see how the mechanism is working, so you can activate them and open and close and see the whole mechanism there. Chimes. Kids love the chimes. They, you know, try to figure out what tunes they can play with three notes. And never gets old. And it just kept going. So this guy here I have in front of me is the magnet. So they were used in pitch and bat games for curveball, for example. They're used in, like, Black Knight and games like that for MagnaSave. They're used in Twilight Zone for the power field. They're still using them. It's the very same magnet from the 40s and the 50s. This one is just set up in a little thing so you can bounce it around and see how putting power into that coil affects where the ball goes. Below that is a manual ball lift. You know, I don't know how many people have ever seen that work on the inside. You just push the lower lever in, and it pops the ball up because originally games had five balls, and you had to load them up one at a time, and it wouldn't feed back the ball for you. You wouldn't believe how many kids think they're launching this thing into space, and they just hit it as hard as they can. You know, it's not, you just got to get it up that far. And then the rototarget will spin and stop just like it does in the game. The lights behind it are to show you that the game needs to know what targets are showing, right? So just because I have, you know, if I were to push that three target now, actually the third light would turn on because it needs to know which target you hit. They're not all the same, and so there's actually wiring on the back that you can see if you turn it around to tell the game which target you've hit. This is a captive ball from games like Apollo or that era that had Casanova had one in the back glass. Down here is a projection unit from the 1940s. Before they had score reels or credit units, they had to put everything on the back glass with lights and visuals. This is a unit that has all the numbers in order around the edge of the wheel. It's like a film strip. And this, I think, was used for the credit on this particular game. So as you put in more quarters, this thing would advance, and you get 3, 4, 5. And there's a light behind it that comes through this hole and through this lens and shines. It would have been the back glass, right? But this just shines on a little filtered piece of glass there. And this thing is different than all the others. We might have saw it in the video there. It's just meant to slow the whole thing down, to almost too slow, to be honest. Most people hit the button and they don't see anything happen and they move on. But it takes the pop bumper through its motion in very slow motion, so you can see the switches moving and the skirt moving and the ball moving and how they all relate to each other. And more and more and more. I've got steppers, I've got varitargets, credit unit, different kinds of motors. I just threw a counter score reels on this motor, so there's something to look at. So kids like to hold down the button and see if they can get it to 1,000 and roll it over. a disappearing post up and down. This one I like because it's a little bit like a piano. As the cams go by, the switches go by in order. So if you take the time, you can actually see, and the lights in front will show you that each cam is actually on a different time, so things happen in a very specific order. So this almost exhausted my initial supply of parts that I wanted to elaborate on, but I did have a trip relay, and a trip relay bank, and I was trying to think of what I could do with a trip relay bank. And I came up with this crazy thing. The trip relay bank is back here. And for those who don't know, trip relays trip once, and then they stay tripped until they are reset. They're used for things like as you're working through the sequence of a game. You know, once you've got the A, you're never going to get the A again. It stays lit, and you're working on the B or the C or the D. That's the trip relays that are doing that. So I could have wired that up to 6 buttons and had you hit the button and have a trip, and there would have been the end of it. This instead, I thought, to make it a little bit more interesting, this is a combination lock, and it's kind of a game. So there are 6 buttons here, and there are 6 lights, including the light here in this pop bumper. And the idea is to go through and to figure out what the combination is that will turn on all 6 lights. So each button only turns on 1 light. So once you've used a button, you don't use it again. It's kind of a mind game to remember which ones you haven't used. and it will count your guesses on the score reels back here. So the object is to see if you can solve the combination in as few guesses as you know as you can, and it becomes kind of a competition. I can these Jones plugs here in the front. I guess there's a zoom in here. I can change the combination for those kids who are got it down and they just keep trying to do it again and again with the same combination. I said, time out, let me change it, and you start over. And then a motor fires off a bell there at the end to let them know that they've completed the sequence. Let me back that up for a minute. I don't know if you recognize what's on the bottom of this game here. That's the bottom board from a generic EM. That's been completely stripped of everything that it had. This hole here would have been the hole for the tilt front at the bottom of the cabinet. So I had this lying around, and it seemed to fit just right for what I needed, so I used that. Well, it turned out that I needed to use that same profile, that same footprint, for the rest of the games, because I need to build crates for them to move them here and there, and to have them all the same shape and size solves a lot of problems. So now I'm in that footprint, and I have to stay in that footprint. So my next big idea was I got my hands on the horse racing unit from games like Hay Burners or Jalopy or Winner, that era, and I wanted to show in all its glory how this thing works and have people be able to watch it work and with all the chains and pulleys and clutches and everything that it's got. So I built this game that's right here in front of me that we can try here in a minute, and I needed to come up with a way to make it engaging, not just hit the button and watch the horse move. I wanted it to be some sort of something that would pull you in and make you, you know, turn it into a real game. So I will explain the rules to the game in a little while, but this is a trial layout to, you know, once you've sort of thought through the game, how it has to work, what parts you need, kind of put together the schematics, you got to take a survey of what all the hardware that you're going to need and how is it going to fit and how can you fit it into your available area and minimize the wiring and keep the dangerous transformer stuff in the back and all sorts of considerations like that. And so this is sort of a dry run. This is the final version here in front. I have a scan here of the horses only because in the original game, the horses went in the opposite direction. They went from right to left in the game, and I wanted to turn them around and go left to right because there's more interesting stuff on the back. In the game, nobody cared, but I wanted to show off the interesting bits. And so I had to scan the horses and flip them so they would go the other way, but then the numbers are flipped, so I had to fix all the numbers so they wouldn't read backwards. Just crazy, crazy stuff. So this is the final version of it, the way it turned out. And in version 2.0, I added these score reels because I've got a box full of these things. Just to give an idea of how hard it is to win. It's not as straightforward as it seems. So I can go, this is like a typical day or a weekend at a maker fair. You know, it might have several hundred games with only a few dozen winners. So people don't get discouraged. They don't think that they've missed something. And this is just some close-ups to show that they're kind of photos right off the website if you want to pursue any of this. All of this stuff is on our website now. So this is a flasher unit out of a Bally game. So this is, if you're familiar with Space Time or Bow and Arrow, it had lights that would keep changing constantly. You didn't have to hit a target. It just kept changing and kept changing and kept changing. And if you hit the target at the right time, then extra special things happened. So that's what this is. This motor just keeps turning through the game. And the chimes are used at the end only if you're a winner do the chimes go off. I'll let you guys try all that here in a minute at the end. So that project was quite a bit more involved. I kind of got knee-deep into this one. That was about 5 or 6 months worth of work to put that whole thing together. And then I thought, what could I do next? What could I do next? And my good buddy Basil here found me a Running Man unit that didn't have a home. So this was, what can I do with a Running Man unit? So I spent a good number of weeks trying to sketch out what could I do with it to show it off, make the game interesting. Lots of sketches of what it would look like, how it would work, you know, the timing of the various circuitry and whatnot, building plans for the crates and all that crazy stuff. And this is an early layout and early wiring, putting the thing together once I've got an idea of where I'm headed with it. I use these alligator clips here. I don't know. You'll have a look later at the end of it. Be good. So the games, EM games, are wired in a certain way. Like the relays in this bank all snap out, so you can examine them and adjust them and whatnot. So you need to have a little bit of slop in your wiring. And the way they handled that was they would make these big loops and tie them together with lacing. And I wanted to reproduce all of that. So a lot of people who see these games think that I just pulled these out of some cabinet and threw the cabinet away and just set them on a table, not realizing that they were all wired from scratch from the ground up, trying to replicate the way of the look from the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. And part of the process is in populating all these relays. So once you've got a schematic, you know how many switches you need on which relay for which situation. So all of these stacks had to be assembled with the right number of relays of the right type. You know, normally open, normally closed, make or break. You know, how many events are happening on each one of these cams. So that all has to be populated first. And then once they're all installed, then you're playing kind of connect the dots with the wiring. You're wiring one point to another based on the schematic. And the game comes apart into four or five pieces so I can move it. And so I've got to put together all the Jones plugs from scratch, you know, based on where's the logic for this and what does it have to talk to and whatnot. The key of this game is there's a skill shot on one side here, and if you're familiar with Twilight Zone or if you're familiar with 4 Million BC, a lot of games have skill shots. This is a skill shot gone crazy. It's got 8 or 9 levels to go through, and trying to get them that close together, I couldn't use the switches and the hardware that's normally used for that sort of thing because they're much further apart typically. Those switches are 2 or 3 inches long, and I only had about 16 or 18 inches to work with. So I had to devise this system of brackets and roller gates and everything. And also I wanted everything to be visible. So all that stuff is usually buried under the play field. You can't really see it. I wanted it to be absolutely obvious what was happening. You're closing the switch and the relay turns on and the light turns on. So everything needed to be up above. So that's why that had to be done more or less from scratch. And at the same, by the same token, at the bottom of the skill shot, there's a holding area while the game does your run or your out or whatever you got. It holds on to the ball until it's done thinking. And even just this silly little sidecar lane gave me a whole new level of respect for the game designers who have to figure out ball dynamics, because getting that thing to work reliably, repeatably, was just crazy nuts hard. Because the ball comes in at different speeds, different angles, and it has to close this switch to tell me that, you know, the play is over, and now I can look at how many bases to give and that sort of thing. So this is a few pictures of it going together. You can see here that once I've got the basic layout of the guts of the game done, I bring in the running man unit, trying to figure out exactly where it needs to fit, and it's sitting here on egg cartons just to try to get the level right. Not knowing exactly how it's going to gather until the last minute. But once I've got measurements and I can figure out it has to be so high above, because I wanted all of this to be obvious too, right? I didn't want to hide any of that. So I wanted to get from a gamer's, you know, the player's perspective, I wanted that all to be apparent. And then I made this whole new frame out for it and put Lexan on the top instead of the plywood that was there originally, because I wanted you to be able to see through to see what's going on inside. And then mounting the original onto this Lexan. And then I needed to transfer enough of the original artwork onto the Lexan. So just, you know, with a template and some holes and some paint, got that through. I didn't transfer everything because, again, it's not really about the artwork. It's about what's going on. So I just needed to get enough information onto that Lexan so you could understand that it's a ball field. And this is where it ended up. And again, we'll be playing here in a minute. And this is just some more close-up stuff. So this stuff is exhibited in public typically at maker fairs. And so I have to be a little bit safety conscious. So like I have to put a clear cover here over the gears since I left the motor exposed. I need to keep little fingers out and things like that. I should mention, by the way, that this is less than half of what there is. You saw all those boards earlier on. They're all set up at Maker Faire in Denver at the Museum of Science right now because it's the same weekend. So I just brought a small sampling here of what there is, and I've got to go and actually do Maker Faire tomorrow on Sunday. So this was just to give you a taste of what's over there. And the skill shot here, this is adjustable, so if it's too easy or too hard and not working well, you can change the pitch of the thing. And just a couple more close-ups for you. Oh, and once you're all done and wired everything up, I go ahead and take my chicken scratch schematics and make real schematics out of it, because now it's complicated enough that if something goes wrong, I can't remember what wire does what. I need a reference for it. So I have full schematics for all of these games now, because someday I'm going to have to service them, and there's just no way around it. So talking about Maker Faire, this is what it looks like in public, you know, and it's a lot of kids, but a lot of parents too that come and have a look at it. This is the reason I do any of this, honestly, is, you know, most of these kids are here, they're pushing the buttons, and they're just going down the line, hitting the buttons and making the noise. But once in a while, you get somebody like this who is just like, okay, I'm going to show my kid how this works. And they spend 5 or 10 minutes, and they're just engrossed in it. And that's what I live for, right? I don't need people banging on the buttons, but when there's somebody getting something out of it, that's my payback. Because this doesn't really pay well. This was the very first Maker Faire, and this is just a typical thing. And the booth is typically busy 9 to 5 during the whole thing. At times, it's 2 and 3 people deep, kind of like it is out on the floor. You know, and you get a lot of kids like this one who's hitting the buttons, but he's looking at something else, right? He's just... But then there's this one who's just trying to figure it out. Is exactly what this is, what I'm trying to accomplish. So it's been at 4 or 5 Maker Faires now over the last few years. And last year in Denver, I kind of lucked out because the people from Make Magazine, who are sort of the holders of the flame of the whole Make thing, came out to Denver and wrote up the whole fair for the weekend. And they threw me up here right on top of their coverage for the weekend, which I, you know, that was pretty slick. This is the baseball game, and it wasn't even done yet. It was just a working, halfway kind of done prototype. And at first I thought, well, it's not done, I shouldn't take it. But honestly, that's really what the Maker Faire thing is all about. It's like, you know, you're experimenting, you're trying. And it was working well enough that I could show it. But now it's got the nice Lex in, and it kind of shows a little bit better. I was showing a video at the beginning, and I'm happy to show these again later on if you want. I won't make you sit through all of these. I do have a website, and all these videos are up there on the website now, which show a lot of these things and how they work. I may be doing more of them. We'll see. I'm not sure about the video thing. It takes a lot of work. I will stop with that. I have a website. If you want to write that down, you're more than welcome to. What I will do here is talk you through these, and you're welcome to come up and try them out. And I will explain the rules here of these two, because they're not immediately apparent. But other than that, thank you for coming, and hope you enjoy the rest of the show.